Enough of a critical mass to kick off. Just before we sort of move on, let's just have a quick recap on what we did last week. Because if you remember, at the end of the session, I put you into little tentative groups and asked you to give me a little bit of feedback on the charts, sort of red, 11 to 20, that sort of position. Just a quick 5-minute discussion. But just as a quick reminder of what we did last week, we looked at the elements of music, and we looked specifically at the relationship between the elements of music and musical form. So how do the elements of music create interest in musical form? And I think that is something of interest for either you as someone who wants to analyse music, but I would also argue that it's of interest if you want to be a songwriter or a composer, because that's basically what composers did, or what composers do. And what we did, I don't want to spend too long on this, we discussed a variety of ways that is common in popular music, and probably the most common technique that we came across is this idea of what I call the rule of four. And if you remember, there was just so much music that fits into this rule of four. I think something like 7 out of the top 10 all fitted into this rule of four. And what's happened with this rule of four is that as sort of Western listeners, we've developed, and it doesn't matter if you're a musician or if you're just a general listener, you sort of have an innate ability to be able to recognise when sections, i.e. verses and choruses, etc., are going to change. And what happens is, when it doesn't fulfil your expectation, it sort of creates a little bit of interest. This is totally subliminal. But, we've all got this innate ability to be able to recognise when particular sections are changing. And what I talked about, we looked at a few examples that are in the top 10 at the moment, but it's no different to music that goes back 10, 20, 30, 40, even in the case of Mozart, it goes back 200 plus years, where his music, Beethoven's music, was divided up quite often into this rule of four. So it really is sort of inbuilt into us, really. And then what we talked about, we just looked at the ways that things like instrumentation can determine form. So how, between sections, different instruments come in. Now, what we haven't talked about, this is something that we will discuss at some point as the weeks go on, but it's more for you to find out, why do these things happen? Okay, they create interest, but are there reasons why these happen? And if you remember, going back 2 weeks, what we spoke about was what I hypothesized is that the interest has to come from somewhere. In music, it has to come from somewhere. So if you've got a piece of music which has only got one chord all the way through, it's not rocket science to work out, well, it needs to have a variety of something, otherwise it will sound boring. The melody needs to be varied, the texture needs to be varied, so on and so forth. So the interest has to come from somewhere. So things like instrumentation, we talked about rhythm. I only played one example, but the Foo Fighters example, if you remember it, it had a particular introduction and then it kicked in to the verse with a totally different rhythm. And I could have quoted countless examples of that. An obvious one is how harmony can determine form, how that changes between sections. Melody is probably the most obvious. Most melodies, in fact, every melody that I've come across, apart from the one example I gave, I'll be interested if you can come across any more. I did challenge you with that, where the verse and the chorus have a different melody. The chorus always has a different melody to the verse, but I did come across this one example. Thus far, it's the only one I've found where you've actually got the same melody for the chorus as what you've got for the verse. And these are the sort of things, as sort of you're sort of making your way in trying to think about music, be it either, musicology is a big word, it could just be, you know, you might get a gig as a music journalist where you've got to go and you've got to analyse an album. You've got to unpick an album. These are things that are useful for that. They're useful tools to get you thinking about how you can begin to unpick music. We also talked about how time signature, and what I was saying with time signature, and again, this is a sort of a hypothesis, is that, you know, back in the day, 20, 30 years ago, in the top 20, you would get music that actually experimented with time signatures determining form. So the chorus would be in a different time signature from the verse. And one example I didn't mention, I mentioned, you know, a few sort of random examples, but Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen's a better example. I just thought of that one there, where it goes into this complex time signature. It's like an instrumental section. You don't get that these days. And what you can start to do is just think, well, why? Why is that? And I gave a few reasons, you know, ranging from a lot of the music written today is composed on computers. And what's the first thing you see on Cubase, Pro Tools, Logic? It opens up a home page and you've got, it tends to encourage you to write in sections. And quite often those sections are symmetrical. So it sticks to the rule of four. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but it's certainly a reason, I think, toward that. And then, of course, there's examples of songs. I put a whole list of songs together on that playlist of examples of songs that aren't in 4-4. And, you know, I mentioned this Take Five by Dave Brubeck. That was in the 50s. That was in the top five. It was a chart hit. Money by Pink Floyd was in the top 10 in America, written in 74. Where is that these days? It's examples of that. Because by understanding what the commonalities are, that's what I was going to say before. By understanding what the commonalities are, you then learn to recognize when those rules are broken. Does that make sense? So you listen to music and you think, well, okay, this is what normally happens. So when something breaks with that, it gives you something to write about and something to think about. And even something, when I say write, I'm not just talking about written words, but also composing music. Are you composing music to a brief where I want to get that music in the top 10, in which case you've got to fit with certain rules? Or do you want to be more experimental? Perhaps it's going to be an album track or something, you know, which is much of the music I've written over the years, where I don't care for getting the charts. I write it for music's sake. There's all a whole range of different reasons why you come across writing music. And then we talked about polyrhythm, how you can have two rhythms at the same time. So in the case of Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, we talked about how it was in both a sort of a 3-4 time and a 4-4 time at the same time. So it's been able to recognise these. Now, I did say to you, and I'll say it again, I can't force you to do this, right? I can't force you to do this. But I put these blogs together, and what I would like you to do, like, as I've said to you a couple of times, the best way to get the most out of this module is to think about what I'm talking about between the lessons. Quite often, that's quite a lot of information imparted. So what you're going to do, you're going to spend at least, I would say, an hour a week, preferably a couple of hours a week at the moment, either reading some of the stuff that I recommend or just listening to music, but listening to it with a critical ear, not just what some musicologists call overhearing. I listen to so much music like that, you know, where I've just got the headphones on and I just listen to it. I'm not thinking about it at all. Do you tend to listen to music like that? You know, where you're not necessarily engaging with it? I find that when you engage with music on a critical level, it's actually quite tiring. And what I would say is, I certainly wouldn't suggest that you engage with music all the time like that, because it takes the fun out of music. Sometimes it is just good to listen to it with headphones on and not analyse it. What I'm saying is, sometimes you need to analyse it to understand what's happening. So a certain amount of time, 2 hours a week, listen to music, read stuff that I recommend that you read, and post on the blog. Because what that does if you go back over the years, I've encouraged students over the last 2 or 3 years to do this, it just gives a catalogue of various students' opinions on how music works. And it's a really useful, quite often feeds into my lectures. And plus, I put the blog together. It only takes me quite a while to put the blog together. It takes me a couple of minutes just to post something. So I'm going to encourage you again this week to get the emails that I send in Blackboard. So I know you've got lots of other modules on, but try and do that with this. You'll get more out of it. And that's basically what we did last week. That's as far as we got. And we finished off the lesson, if you remember, where I put you into groups and I said we'd have a quick 5-minute conversation, just a quick conversation, about how this, what I've just spoken about, how that works in some of the music. So I mentioned, because I'd already talked about the top 10, I talked about positions 11 to 20, but also perhaps things like the polyrhythm. You're not going to get that in the top 20, but there might be some album tracks that you might have come across. So I can't remember where you were sitting last week, but what I did, I put you into these groups. It was never intended to be a precise thing, but if you are sitting in similar positions, there were some people here who aren't here. Were you guys in one group?
Yeah. No.
So, that's okay. I can't remember if I numbered you now. I probably should have, but let's go with you guys. Just general observations that you found in the top, in those chart positions.
A lot of them will use sort of texture to define their sections, and a lot of them will start the first half of a verse very thin, sort of vocals and maybe one instrument. Second half of the verse or a second verse will sort of be a lot thicker. It'll build up to a chorus.
So very texture in the verse.
Yeah, but as it builds in the sort of second half of the verse, then a few of them will sort of drop the texture for either a beat or a full bar before the chorus comes in.
Right.
Give it sort of an extra kick when everything sort of comes in on the chorus. Then, like.
Yeah, and what about the... Did you notice anything about the rule of four?
Yeah, it fits into a lot of that, and they're sort of equal size verses, so you could call it one or two or A and B or whatever, but they were the same size. It was just thinking in the texture, bringing something in from the introduction over or underneath it, and it just sort of gave it a different, even though the melody was the same in the second verse, it was sort of...
The texture.
It was the texture.
And again, let's go around a few people and then try to consider why that is. Because I've noticed that texture in top 20 is really important. Change in texture, it seems to be an important... Were you guys in a group?
Yeah.
Yeah? Any observations?
I've got texture written down pretty much every single one, bar one where it's quite subtle. Because most of the songs sort of have, drop, or just making the chorus huge.
Yeah.
Catch people's eye on the radio.
And did you notice any anomalies? Any?
On this, that 30 WAP tune, it's like number 20.
Yeah.
The texture does change, like it drops the snare.
Drawing
the pre-chorus and then comes with bass, it's subtle as the rest of them. So that one's like very strongly on.
Yes, but it's subtle. Just a subtle change in texture, you're saying.
Whereas the rest of them are not very, very obvious, but that one's subtle. It's all about the melody and rhythm, that one, working together.
And when you say rhythm, what do you mean?
So in the chorus, and the verse, the rhythm changes in the vocal melody, and it's just like very key to the song.
Yeah. And what we should draw back to with that is, remember lecture one, we talked about song, arrangement and track. Can you begin to see now the differences between the song and the arrangement? Everything we're talking about virtually is arrangement. Not everything. We tend to call it the song, but with a capital S. But if we think about song, arrangement and track, song being the general melody, the chord sequence, sort of the basic form. But all of these other things are related to the arrangement of the piece. But no anomalies, but some subtle use of texture, which is a sort of a production value, isn't it? That you, and again, I would argue you need this in commercial music because the interest isn't necessarily coming from elsewhere. I'm generalising, but what about you guys? Were you in a group? Yeah. Well, you just join in with your group whenever I get to. Yeah, next one. Yeah, so. Yeah, but keep it informed. So, what do you guys spot?
One of the songs, like every section split up into 16 bars each, perfectly.
So, 16 bar sections?
Yeah. And the main thing is that I'm just jumping on songs, building out throughout the whole song. The other song was the pre chorus was 9 bars instead of 8.
Oh, okay. Which one's that?
My Face by The Weeknd.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The last pre-chorus, an extra bar, it's another like build up front fill.
Yeah.
And it kind of just sets you back, kind of surprises.
Yeah, because you're expected to happen a bar early. And what you can do, you see, by spotting that sort of thing, where it isn't just symmetrical 8-bar sections, it's got an extra bar in, what you can do if you listen to music critically, you can draw that into a wider practice. For example, you could take it back to the Beatles, you could take it back to Motown, there's lots of other examples, and you can think about why it's happening. For example, when you listen to a Robert Johnson track from the 1930s, I think it was the 1930s he recorded those records, or Big Bill Bronzy, one of the great blues players, quite often they're called 12-bar blues, but their music isn't 12 bars long. You'll find loads of them have got like 13-bar sections, 14-bar sections, and I know a lot of the rhythm section guys, when they came across to the UK, not Robert Johnson, but people like Howlin' Wolf, when he came across to the UK in the 60s and supported the Rolling Stones, a lot of the rhythm section guys who were UK-based really struggled playing with them because it wasn't 12-bar blues. It was more intuitive, where they whatever they felt like, they added the odd bar on at the end of sections and stuff, where we're not talking about that, we're talking about it for a different reason. But it's still part of the same sort of practice. Next group. Are you guys in it?
Yeah,
I just put it
back
to.
Yeah, so, yeah. We kind of focused on just like one or two things. We noticed that structure-wise, most of them had like pretty much the same structure.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them had intros and outros, but most of them just kind of verse-chorus.
Verse-chorus.
Occasionally a bridge. And the ones we listened to, we reckon that pretty much about all of them were in 4/4.
Yes.
So not one of them broke.
Everyone agree with that? Yeah, I've got to admit I haven't listened to them. I'm just curious.
That was
so,
just what we heard.
Yeah, so they're all in, it's not even in a complex time signature yet. Not even in 3/4/4. Everything's in 4/4. What about tempos? No, something about tempos.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing. We did entertain the idea that quite a lot of them were dance tunes, so they kept it 4/4 simple.
120 beats a minute,
yeah,
probably.
Just to dance to.
Yes.
So we figured that was
And it may be, you know, it may be, when you think about the top 20, it may be that the fact that at the moment, perhaps it is dominated by dance music, and if it's dance music, you can sort of begin to understand why it's in 4/4, it's probably 120 beats a minute. You can understand it's so easy on Cubase and Logic to play around with texture, isn't it? You just sort of add things in sections. And again, it sort of feeds my opinion that a lot of the music is composed on computer. And by it being composed on computer, what it's doing is mixing the songwriting process with that of the arrangement. You know, the arrangement and the song, as opposed to it being I get the impression someone like Ed Sheeran, for example, he will write the song, and then he'll arrange it, and then he'll record it. I would imagine it sounds like he's got a very sort of old-fashioned way of approaching songwriting, where a lot of this music we're talking about, I would imagine, and again, how do you find that out? You look for interviews and you look for evidence of what you suspect, but I suspect the song and the arrangement are sort of unified. They're doing this at the same time. They're recording the song and the arrangement really exactly at the same time. Was there anything else? Any other? Yeah. What about you guys?
We weren't here.
You weren't here? No worries. You guys?
What we found is that pretty much all of the instrumentation is the same. It's pretty much all computerized.
All computerized, right.
In the top five, there's a mixture. Which I like Sam Smith and yeah. Adele in there, but and then in the 20s pretty much all dance, electronic. So all the instrumentation is the same and the structure. It's all simple little tests.
So a lot of repetition. It's interesting you mentioned Sam Smith and Adele. You know, I would argue they're probably in a very similar category to Ed Sheeran, the way they write music. But there are traditional songwriters out there, and oddly enough, they're really appreciated. They're huge, aren't they? Adele, Ed Sheeran, massive sort of impact. It's almost like alongside the dance music, there's become an appreciation of the singer-songwriter. You know, it's Ed Sheeran, just him and a guitar, playing at Wembley Stadium. Something back to basics, isn't it? And it's interesting how that contrasts with what we're talking about here, which is largely computerized music. Anything else? Anyone notice anything about, because you mentioned textures being the big thing, has anyone noticed anything about sounds? Because it's, I always find it interesting when a new bit of technology comes out, how records can be dominated by particular sounds. This goes all the way back to probably the 70s. You got it with more production values in the 60s. Certain production values became popular, but as soon as technologies like drum machines started to come about in the 70s, those sounds dominated records, or particular synths that came out, like the Fender Rhodes in the 70s. There's loads of records with Fender Rhodes on. In the 60s, the Mellotron. You know, the use of the Mellotron was used a lot in the 60s, and it almost gives a sort of a time stamp to the record we're talking about. Did anyone notice anything about, so what we would call, not texture, but timbre, the sound of the instruments? Did anyone notice anything unusual about that? And maybe that's something to listen to see if there is a stamp, a sound stamp, with the top 20. Have I missed anyone out? Were you guys involved in any of the discussion, or were you here, or I can't remember now? Mm-hmm. No, you weren't here. Okay. That's useful. It would be really good to have that captured on the blog, so that we can, with some YouTube links and stuff, so we can sort of listen into it and watch it a bit. So try and do that this week. Okay, what I want to talk about this week, we have used a fair bit of time on that talk, but I think it was important, is we're going to do this over the next 2 weeks. We're going to talk about this idea of the sandbox, which I don't profess to take any credit for that name. It comes from a musicologist, a guy called Alan Moore. And I've uploaded the paper that he wrote, which discussed this. So I'm going to recommend at the end of the session that you read that paper. He wrote it with a PhD student called Ruth Dockaway. And it's just an interesting paper about what we're going to be talking about today. And what we'll do more next week, we'll talk about musical environment. Because music creates a virtual space that we sort of inhabit. You know, it's not, there's not a separation between us and the music. Quite often we inhabit the music, and that's where I'm coining this phrase, musical environment, but we'll come on to that next week. A few things I mentioned to you before about the idea of critical listening. So, you know, try and set yourself a goal, as opposed to just listening to music while, like I have done this morning, listened most of a 1 hour train journey. I had music on, but I wasn't really concentrating. It was just sort of in my ear, and I was sort of overhearing it. Spend a bit of the week where you sit down, even if it's for 15, 20 minutes, and listen to the music critically. You can start to listen to the things that we've talked about thus far, song arrangement and track, musical elements, so on and so forth. And also, you can start to listen to music with this in mind as well. Like, if you think of the sandbox as a sort of a three-dimensional space, okay? And since the advent of stereo, anyway, what we do, we listen to music in this space where there's highs and there's lows. So, for example, there's hi-hats, there's falsetto voices, there's high-pitched guitars right at the top. And then at the bottom, you've got your bass drums, you've got your low end of the piano, and possibly, you know, if it was rock music, certainly in the death metal genre, you know, these detuned guitars, you've got that type of thing as well. So you listen to music in terms of height, from top to bottom. And you also listen to it in depth. A lot of people don't really listen to it like this. I think you can pick it up much better, the stuff we're going to listen to today. These speakers are okay, but then you really need to listen to it on a decent system, through headphones, I would say, but all through a decent system at home. But what I mean by depth is the distance from front to back. So certainly since the advent of studio technologies such as compression and reverb, what studio engineers have been able to do is give the illusion that some music is further forward and some music is further back. So you've got this height in the music we listen to, and you've also got a depth from front to back. And it's interesting how that changes with the genre of music that you're listening to. There'll be some music where you may want, you know, the drums really far forward, where there's other music where the drums are quite often at the back. Depends on genre. And of course, the last of the three-dimensional space, you've got height, you've got depth, which is, as I say, used by mainly through studio technology. And you've also got the stereo spectrum, which so many of us, you know, me included, you take for granted. I think stereo was invented around 1959, but it took quite a while for it to sort of kick through to the mainstream. You know, a lot of those early Beatles records, for example, were recorded in mono. Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, which is known as a stereo classic, that was recorded in mono originally. So it took quite a while for stereo to catch on. You know, a lot of people didn't have the technology to play it. They only had mono systems. So a lot of the records that were produced in mono, not stereo. We tend to take it for granted that we've got this this sort of spectrum going from left to right. And it begs questions, you know. How do these things evoke the mood of the music? And in terms of the stereo spectrum, is it static? Or does it change? We'll come on to that in a second. What happens when the instruments in the stereo spectrum change? And I mentioned the general volume as well. That's a sort of an afterthought. These are the three things I'm trying to get you to think about. Height, depth, and width in music. Start to listen to that when you're listening to music. Because what that'll do, not only will it develop your critical ear, it'll get you thinking about when you produce your own music. What's the best ways of doing this? The best way of doing that is by listening to how other people do it. But quite often what's difficult is you haven't got the vocabulary to explain what you hear. I think sometimes words and when you're trying to describe music can be quite limiting. It's very difficult to put some of the things that you hear into words. That's the problem we've got in music criticism. Yeah, and you can listen to things like, are there any double tracking? You know, a couple of weeks ago we listened to that example of Yesterday where Paul McCartney was singing and there was accidental double tracking where he was singing in a microphone but his voice was also caught by the microphone on the guitar and consequently you had two versions of the voice. These days, virtually every record is double tracked. Can you hear that? It's so easy to double track. Like somebody said a few weeks ago, all you do is just copy and paste the vocal. These days, in technology, you just control C, control V. You've got to, and perhaps offset it a little bit so it's not absolutely, you know, a few milliseconds either way, and you've got a double track vocal. It's so easy to do it. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many mixers these days use it, certainly in the pop stuff. Another thing to perhaps ask yourself And I would argue, again, everybody as a musician should be able to do this. Can you recognise any effects that are being used? So, you know, can you recognise the use of compression on a drum kit? Do you know what that sounds like? Can you recognise delay? That's a bit easier to recognise, the delay effect, which again is used a lot in dance music. But again, it's got a history going back to the 1950s with Les Paul. The guy who invented the Les Paul guitar also invented double tracking. The fact that we can overdub in a recording studio. Can you recognise effects like chorus? They're just three of the more common ones. And, you know, if you can't, what I would do these days, it's so easy. Google, what does chorus sound like? There'll be examples of people, that's what it sounds like. Then start listening out for it.
What is chorus?
Well, it's just basically just, I know it through being a guitar player. There's a chorus pedal that, and what it does, it plays around with the signal of the guitar so that you've got two signals, basically. And you can manipulate the distance between the original signal and the copied one.
Oh, okay.
But it's also used on vocals. You can hear it on vocals. And, you know, phase is another effect. These are effects that sort of came through in the 1960s, but they're still used today. Not just on guitars, in general mixes. And like I say, with Google, it's very easy. Just what does it sound like? Listen to it, then try and spot it. And then what happens is when you listen to music, you can talk about these things. And of course, use of EQ. So, you know, these are the big three: frequency, depth, stereo placement. But these are other things to listen for. For example, I, being a guitar player, I can always hear. I know from having a fair bit of experience in recording studios that the guitar signal is really problematic, because it's got a huge frequency range. And what you find in mixes, when you get the guitar mixed, they always, usually anyway, depending on the genre, they roll off loads of the bottom end on the guitar. And you can hear that sometimes in the mix. It's dead easy to hear it when you hear the guitar on its own. If you take all the instruments out, just hear the guitar, you think, that guitar sounds terrible. Put the rest of the instruments in, suddenly it sounds okay. But the reason that the bottom end is rolled off, I mean, this isn't a music technology session, but it's just so you can begin to recognise some of these things, is so some of the other instruments can breathe. So how is equalisation used? And this will feed in, it should feed into the recording stuff that you've done and are doing at the moment, but you're thinking of it in a slightly different way. Does anyone know what those terms are? Is the texture homophonic or polyphonic? What's the difference? Anyone come across those terms? Anyone? Yeah?
So, homophonic is just kind of like, it's like one, isn't it? So it's like just kind of,
yes,
melody harmony. Polyphonic is where there's like multiple melodies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It, for those that didn't hear that, the homophonic is it's almost like a single strand. It could be melody, bass, and drums, but the idea is it's a single strand. It comes from classical terminology, where polyphonic is multiple voice. The first polyphonic keyboards, for example, you take those for granted. At one point, synthesizers can only play one note at a time. You couldn't play chords. And the first time I heard of the terminology polyphonic was then, when suddenly you could actually play chords on synthesizers. They weren't what they called monophonic, one note at a time. It was polyphonic. Quite often polyphonic comes across with the term contrapuntal as well. Contrapuntal meaning lots of different melody lines at the same time. But it's a sort of a classical terminology, but you do hear it quite a lot in the popular music industry, to be honest. Okay, well, we're not going to have a huge amount of time to listen. And as you know, last week I had all sorts of problems with this technology. I'm hoping that I'm not going to have those problems today. But what we'll do, we'll just listen to some little short excerpts of some of these tracks, and then I'll put that Spotify playlist together for you. And what I suggest you do is listen to these in their entirety during the week, so you can listen to them in much more depth. All I can do is just play little bits of it today. So, okay, here's hoping that it's going to play, eh? So, just listen to this, and we'll talk about the mix.
I walked into Lindy's, tired and tired.
So you listen to some of the things we've been speaking about.
Me and my Julie, been fighting all night. Bankroll don't like it. When I come in late, we got a big beef with a salt concern. We must liquidate. Cat down to the same mark for looky loo. They all landed in the lobby. Then we do what we come to do. Lots of good and easy. More takes it in your face. Wine bud butters, run for cover.
Okay. There we are. That wasn't too painful. I managed to listen to that anyway. Just for that short bit that we listened to, are there any observations with what I've spoken about? Anything anyone's spotted about height, depth, width, anything?
The bass is like really squashed and flat, like really low end.
Yeah. Did anyone else pick up on that? Squashed, flat, not just the bass, but also the drums. You listen to how tiny the drums are. You know how big a drum kit sounds when you listen to it real, but it's been squashed along with the bass. So it fits in this three-dimensional space then. There's space for other instruments to go around it. Anyone notice anything else with that? Anything in terms of, you know, was there any stereo placement in there? You hear some stereo placement? It's not the best stereo in the world, but you could certainly hear the guitar was across in one speaker. It was a pretty static mix, but it was definitely... And you could also argue that, in terms of frequency, it occupied, you had the vocals at the top, the hi-hats at the top, going all the way down to the bass. Anyone knows what a bass drum sounds like? I mean, listen to this again.
When a child comes up so loud,
small the drum kit.
Then it break out the good stuff. The boss wants a party all night.
In the stereo placement. The big thing I was trying to put across there was the use of compression, though. How these things, you can really make some instruments sound quite small through the use of compression. Alan Moore as well. I'm going to be coming back to Alan Moore quite a lot. There's two books I would recommend if you want to start reading in the library now to sort of get a grasp of stuff. There's two books by Alan Moore that are great. There's a book called Rock the Primary Text, which was actually originally written in 1993, believe it or not, going back a long time now. Really good book, just talking about the basics of how to go about analysing music. It's an easy to read book, well recommended. And a couple of years ago he wrote another book called Song Memes, which is how do we go about analysing songs. And he used quite a lot of the ideas from Rock the Primary Text in that. But in both of those books he talks about, similar to what I've just been saying here, but another way we can listen to music is thinking of them as specific layers, and we can talk about them. So we can talk about, like, a beat layer. In that last track, you know, you've got specific beats, the drums, you can talk about what sort of rhythm the drum is, How is the bass guitar fitting in with that? How is the guitar the guitars fitting in with that? The keyboards. So a particular beat there you could talk about. What he calls, that's not my phone, that's okay. A particular bass layer, the sort of lower end of the mix, if you like. The melodic layer, where it's obviously the melody, or the melodies that are in a piece of music. And at the minute, I haven't given you any tools to talk about melody, but I will do in a few weeks' time. And last but not least, the harmonic layer. How do the chords fit together? So that's another way that you can begin to think about how do I write about music. I think what you need to get started with writing about music is you just need to have some starting points. I always start from a mind map, where you know, I might start, if I'm doing this type of analysis, starting just from the elements of music, listen to the music, start to jot down the elements of music, and then write some notes about them. Or you could talk about what I've just said here, the frequencies, the stereo spectrums, all this type of stuff. You can just have these as sub-headings. And as you're listening to the music, just jot down ideas. And eventually it'll start to, hopefully, make sense into an essay. I'm not going to listen to this, but what I suggest you do is just listen to this Bon Iver track, if anyone's heard it, Perth. It's a very sparse mix. And you know, there's specific ways that that track uses these various layers. There's not really a bass layer in it, for example. So sometimes some of these layers are missing. What I wanted to get onto is this. I just want to make sure I've got time to talk about this. So Alan Moore's Soundbox that I mentioned right at the start, okay? If you can begin to imagine the stereo spectrum. You know, we talked about the frequency, we talked about the width, and we talked about the depth, which is going back or going forwards. If you can sort of imagine the stereo spectrum that you're listening to as a sort of a three-dimensional space like this, does that make sense? So it's a sort of a three-dimensional space. And what I want you to begin to look out for are... Sorry, one more. Four types of mixes, right? And we'll explain what these units are called. But first of all, the cluster mix, right? The cluster mix. Because what I said before about sometimes terminology lets us down. You think, well, okay, I'm experiencing the music, but how do I write about that? In order to write about it, you need a vocabulary. So words like polyphonic, monophonic, contrapuntal, frequency, compression, chorus, soundbox, song, arrangement, and track, all these things are giving you a vocabulary through which you can actually write down what you're hearing. That's what the theory is. And so when you're hearing a mix, as opposed to sort of going, well, this instrument's here, that instrument's they're describing each instrument in turn. You can think of them a bit more generally like this. And these are just a few mixes to listen out for, the most common ones. The first one's a cluster mix, where all of the instruments are grouped together in a cluster. So you've got the stereo spectrum, but what you'll find is sometimes you get all of the instruments sort of grouped together. And usually it's not in the middle. It's normally offset, so it's normally just to the left or just to the right. I don't know why. That's where you would have to, I'm no sound engineer, you speak to engineers and producers to find out why they do that. You know, they group the instruments together and then just put them slightly to one side. And that's called a cluster mix. The triangular mix is a really interesting one. I've got a challenge for you guys at the end of the lecture with this one. It's a mix that I tend to associate with the 1960s. And what you'll get, quite often with a triangular mix, you'll get like the vocals across in the right speaker, and you'll get the drum kit across on the left. You don't hear that these days. It's, you know, you hear it in a lot of early 60s recordings, in particular like Jimi Hendrix stuff. But in lots of other stuff, you hear the drum kit just panned across into one speaker. You don't hear that a lot these days. That's called a triangular mix. Even the vocals, we're so used to hearing the vocals in the middle, in modern mixes. But the triangular mix, quite often the vocals will be either left or right. So, again, one of the reasons behind that. The diagonal mix is the one that we're more familiar with, where, as I say there, you've got usually the bass, the drums, and the vocals in the middle. And then what you'll get are other instruments peppered around it. So you might have keyboards and backing vocals on either side of them. But bass, drums, and vocals are normally in the middle, broadly. You know, they're not like this. It's sort of like this, if the stereo spectrum is this broad. And last but not least is the dynamic mix. And the dynamic mix is one where it actually changes through time. So, for example, you could have a guitar part which starts here, and it gradually moves across to here. So it's a dynamic mix. And they're going to be used very subtly because they're going to be quite confusing. But you do hear them. So four types of mixes for you to think about. What we're going to do very quickly, once I've just gone through this, is just listen to some quick examples of those mixes, and then that's more or less what we're doing. What I do want to point out, there's no dates on this, but this sort of runs from the mid-1960s, early 1960s, through to, let me get this right, I think it runs through to about 2005, the dates I put off. But it's this that I'm interested in, how in the 60s, what this research was, it was an analysis of, it may have been 1,000 mixes. I may be wrong, it may be less than that, but they analysed a great number of mixes. And what they found was the triangular mix got less and less. So the one where the drums are across here, the vocals are here, got this real big stereo separation. In the 1960s, there was no diagonal mix where the bass, drums, and vocals are in the middle. And there's reasons for this, which I'm not going to tell you. I want you to think about that. But what happened is, over the years, the diagonal mix grew and the triangular mix disappeared. And that's a general tendency that you get. These days, you tend not to get. In fact, I would be very interested to know what these 11 triangular mixes are. In modern day, because I can't hear any examples today of triangular mixes, and that's what I want you to try and find out. We're not going to try and necessarily answer these questions, but these are things that I want you to think about. Why has that happened? I know we haven't listened to them yet. We'll listen to them. Should probably put these questions at the end. But why has the triangular mix disappeared, and why has diagonal mixes emerged? You know, is it because of technology? We're now in stereo. Diagonal mixes sound better in stereo than triangular mixes. Is it because listening habits? We tend to listen to a lot of music on headphones these days. In fact, we have since the 1970s, although it's not as much as what it is now. But, you know, what Walkmans, as they were called, were around in the 1970s, so people started to listen to music on headphones from the late 70s. Is that why diagonal mixes have emerged? This is what I challenge you with. Help me find some examples of triangular mixes today that are used in the last 5 years. I'd love to hear some. Let's listen to some examples. As I say, I don't think it's too bad, this, but it's not the best stereo system in the world. What I would do is just listen to some of them with headphones on when you get home, or on a better system. I was listening to them at the weekend, even on this, just through the speakers on the Mac, and they sounded really good. But I'm not sure how it's going to come out on this, but we'll see. So hopefully we'll be able to listen to a couple of examples of the triangular mixer. So let's listen to this. Hopefully. I think you can't hear it actually. Yeah, can you hear how the drums are panned far left?
After all the jets are in the bottles.
The vocals are in the right.
the clowns all gone to the bed. You can hear happiness stamping on downstream.
With loads of reverb.
Full of reverb on that drum kit. Dressed in red.
Stacks of reverb.
And the wind whispers clearly.
Here's another Hendrix example. Like that anymore, you know. I love those mixes. Some of them, though, for example, if you listen to Sgt. Pepper's, which large parts of it are mixed like this, it hurts your ear. If you listen to it in headphones, the bottom end is like, man, that's really sort of digs into your ear a bit. And it wasn't designed to be listened on headphones. I think headphones are probably part of the reason why it disappeared. Possibly. I've not seen anything written about it, so I don't know. The cluster mix that I mentioned, it may be difficult to hear it on this, but remember the cluster mix is where the instruments are grouped together, but to one side. Just listen to a little bit of this by Donovan.
Just meant about saffron. A saffron meant about me. I'm just meant about saffron. She's just meant about me. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow.
Let me say that's a lot more difficult to spot that one. It's easier with headphones. You can hear there's not a lot of spread. It's almost like a mono mix in a stereo field, a cluster mix. And the diagonal mix that I mentioned, if you remember, bass drums and vocals in the middle and other instruments either side. I've just chosen an example from the early 70s of that sort of mix where this is when this sort of mix was really becoming popular. Post-1960s, bigger recording studios, mono was beginning to disappear, the embracement of stereo, and suddenly you started to get mixes more like this. You hear it's very different to the Beatles one. Got the bass in the middle, drums in the middle. Hopefully done is just give you a little bit of a taster. This isn't a great system. What you've got to do with this to get your head around the difference between these different mixes is to definitely listen to these things in their entirety, probably with headphones on. And the last type of mix, what I've also got, we haven't got time to listen to it, I've got examples of the diagonal mix going all the way through to the present day. It dominates all the top 20 stuff you hear now. All of it will be made up of the diagonal mix. But in terms of examples of the dynamic, right, how it changes, just listen to, let's just listen to the beginning. Actually, it's not that one, it's this one. Just the start of this. Do you hear that?
Yeah.
The guitar went, I don't know what direction it went, it was either left or right or left. It's an example of a very rapid dynamic mix. I think it went that way. And you will hear, I sometimes play a Queen of the Stone End, Queen of the Stone Age track, Songs from the Dead. And quite often you can hear in that one, if you listen to it in headphones here, the drums start off here and they move to the centre as the mix progresses. You know that track? You can hear that. To finish off, the challenge I've got for you, we'll summarise it properly in a second, but examples of triangular mixes that are around today. Don't think for a minute, I'm sure you know, there's loads of bands that are influenced by 1960s music. There's a couple of examples here, for example. This is by a band called A La Las. And just listen to this. It's 1960s, but it's not in the triangular mix. So it's got all the 60s traits. It was released 2 years ago, in 2013. It's got like a bit of a psychedelic sort of vibe about it. So it's about the 60s as it gets. But it's a diagonal mix, not a triangular mix. Put all these on the blog on Spotify so you can hear them. But another one to finish off by a band called The Spirals. Again, it was released 2 years ago. Actually try to move in the direction of a triangular mix. So we've got sort of drum kit both sides, but it's not at one side. That's the key sort of ingredient with it. Alright, to finish off, just move this through. What I would like you to do, like I said, Reconfiguring the Sandbox by Alan Moore and Ruth Dockway. It's a good paper to read. It's all about what I've been talking about today, and it's a really good paper to read. I'm going to put a blog together, okay? I'll put up this Spotify list. I'll post it. I'll send you the link. I'll email you the link. Respond to it. Right, listen to it, listen to some of the examples, try and understand what I've been talking about, and respond to the blog. Listen to the examples on headphones, and try and consider the reasons behind the demise of the triangular mix. Why is music not mixed that way anymore? I've got some ideas of my own, but I want you to think about them, and we'll talk about them next week. That's it. There's a QA site, so thanks a lot. I'll see obviously some of you now and some of the rest of you on Friday for the seminar. Thanks.
Yeah.